You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Strobe Talbot of the Brookings Institution, and I am particularly appreciative that you all would come and be part of this important, in some ways somber, but in many ways I'm sure you will find quite inspiring event. Most of the activities that take place here in the Falk Auditorium at Brookings concern the human enterprise, which is, in a way, human nature writ large, which is to say we are usually on this podium and with the involvement of the audience talking about progress that human beings can take credit for, mistakes that they can be blamed for, and if we're talking about disasters, whether it's wars or policy debacles, once again, they are self-inflicted. Sometimes, though, the human enterprise itself falls victim not to human nature, but to Mother Nature. Of course, there was an example of that in the great tsunami of 2004. There was an example of that here in this country in Katrina. And then, of course, a year ago, there was the great East Japan earthquake. The death toll, which is nearly 16,000, is in fact even more staggering than that number quite captures. And that's because even a year later, the final figure for the number of people who almost certainly perished is not yet known. Many of the victims are not yet accounted for. There is, however, another dimension to the disaster alongside the horror and the sorrow, and that's the dimension of the resilience of the human spirit, which has been manifest, of course, at the level of many, many thousands of individuals, but also at the level of communities, and two communities in particular. One is the community known as the Nation of Japan, 130 million strong, and I do mean strong. And the other is the global community, 7 billion strong. The response of both of those communities to what happened a year ago was nothing less than magnificent. And both those communities are represented here today. The world, in a sense, is represented by all of us in this room. And that includes one representative of the diplomatic corps, and it could not be a more appropriate representative, both in his own personal capacity and also the country that he represents. I'm referring to Ambassador Vegard Strømmen of Norway. Norway's contribution to the relief efforts was really quite remarkable. Just another example of the way, in the most positive sense, Norway continues to lead and to punch above its weight. In the immediate aftermath of the disaster, Norway rushed to the scene, search and rescue teams, and there is today a continuing effort to cooperate with our Japanese friends to rebuild the Japanese fishing fleet. The American people's response is represented by a Marine and a diplomat. General Mark Berlakas was absolutely instrumental in Operation Tomodachi, and in particular, the U.S. Armed Forces' contribution to Japan's recovery efforts. Also, on the civilian side, we're very fortunate to have with us today Mark Knapper, the director of the Office of Japan Affairs at the Department of State. As for the Japanese nation, the Japanese people, they are represented by their government's ambassador, and I should say superb ambassador, Ichiro Fujisaki. A year ago, only 7 days after the disaster hit, the ambassador stood at this podium, at this lectern, and earned one of the very few standing ovations that we've ever seen on these sedate premises at the Brookings Institution. He spoke with eloquence, poignancy, grace, gratitude, and above all, quiet fortitude and confidence. He ended his remarks a year ago by saying, "We shall overcome this." And indeed, his countrymen and countrywomen have begun to do just that. We will hear first, appropriately, from Ambassador Fujisaki himself, then from General Berlakis, then from Mr. Napper. And in order to bring all of you into the proceedings, Richard Bush, my friend and colleague who directs our Center for Northeast Asia Policy Studies, will moderate a discussion. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much, Strobe. I also vividly remember 1 year ago you have given me a chance to speak here only few days after the disaster. And that was the first time I came out to public and in the think tank, and I was so grateful that you have given me a chance to convey what Japanese people are thinking. And thank you very much, the people here, to be here again. I am often asked by American friends today, how are the Japanese people feeling today, now, after 1 year? And I'm always saying that it's rather difficult to sum it up. Some people feel that there's much progress has been done. Some people think too little. Some people think that a lot of things happened in 1 year. Some people feel that it's only yesterday. So it's very varied. It depends on how what people are situated. But one thing that is common is that, and what can assure is that we are on the recovery road. But because of the disaster was so big, as just explained, magnitude 9.0, 130 feet tsunami, killed nearly 16,000 people, still nearly 3,000 people unidentified and missing. It's difficult to say that we have already recovered. No, we are on the recovery road. And what's important is that we are not only reconstructing, we have to create a society that is more resilient. Not just to do what we were doing, because then we would meet again these disasters. So we have to create a system that would be more resilient than before. So in a way, it's a renaissance into 21st century, not only regional issue, but whole Japan. This is the challenge that we are facing. I would make a sort of status report from three angles: people, infrastructure, and energy. People, as I said, it was a huge disaster, and there are a lot of orphans as well. Some people have been very strong. There were 33 foreigners has lost their lives. Two young Americans included. One is a student from Alaska who are teaching English in Japan, Monty. One was a girl named Taylor Anderson from Virginia. We got to be friends with their parents. These people were really magnificent. Parents said that Taylor would not like to see that March 10th, 2011 was the most happiest days in our life, the parents' life. She would like us to be happy. So we'll be positive. So they solicited, collected funding from the alumni of Taylor School and initiated a Taylor library and donated bookshelves with the books that she liked to Japanese schools in the affected area, nine schools that she taught. And the bookshelves were designed and made by a carpenter and furniture maker whose name is Endo. We met him when we visited the area. He lost all his children, but he thought this kind, he wanted to engage in this as well. So they are very strong people and very positive people there. But not all the people can be like that. So government has to help. We're sending expert teams to help them as well. And government is trying to contribute to their living by about giving about $65,000 per household, which has lost the main earners of life, and also power companies is contributing, and we have received more than $4 billion from around the world, including United States, very large portion, and 80% is already distributed. So these are the helps that people are receiving. As for housing, the peak, 380,000 people had to be evacuated from the region. And the government has supplied by August about 50,000 houses. And now about 600 people are still living in shelter, and 17,000 people living in the friend's house. But most people are out of shelters now. 81,000 people have lost the jobs and were receiving employment benefit, unemployment benefit last summer. By the end of year, about 20,000 has found the jobs. So it's very still difficult because 51,000 acres were inundated, and 28,000 fishing boats were lost. So we have to create jobs there and create the boats and things like that. And government is determined to have 90% of farmland restored in 5 years' time. This is the about the people's life. As for infrastructure, the damage was about $212 billion. Infrastructure and housing and equipment. As for infrastructure alone, it was $44 billion. Katrina, it was $5.5 billion. So you can see how big it was. Now, electricity, highway, railway is all almost back. As for debris on the land, 96% has been already cleared. But the final disposal, most of them we have to wait. Some of the debris went out to the Pacific Ocean, and we are monitoring very carefully. The expert team of Kyoto University has gone to Hawaii and discussed, and will be very carefully monitoring. I think it's important for us to take that responsibility in following that. As for supply chain problem, which was often discussed, I have to note that sometimes it's a bit exaggerated, because if you... some people say that U.S. car production was affected so much because of lack of auto parts coming from Japan. If you take U.S. car production of 2007 as 100, after Wall Street crash, Lehman shock, it went down to 36 for a while. As for the supply chain issue after earthquake, it was at 85 level for a very short period. So it's not comparable to anything like a Wall Street crash. I have to exaggerate. I have to say that. As for the money to compensate this, government has allocated $225 billion. And this is about 26% of annual budget. except for the repayment of debt. So this is a huge amount has been already allocated. Lastly, nuclear and energy. This is a very important issue. We have received a tremendous support from the United States, and 50 experts were there, and we have come to a stage equivalent to cold shutdown in December. But as for decommissioning of the reactor itself, it'll take decades. As for the contaminated area, by March, we'll verify the land, and if there's a if we find that this is already under 20 microsievert, if the infrastructure is restored, the local communities will, mayors will have the, can start lifting the restrictions to go in, and I think people can go back. So it depends on the people after this. As for the level of contamination, often we think that Fukushima was very difficult, but one thing I have to say is that compared to Chernobyl, for example, there was no reactor explosion. There was container vessel as well. So radioactive material discharge was 1/7 of that of Chernobyl. So the level of contamination of Tokyo is somewhere in between major cities of United States and France, and it's almost identical to the U.S. and France now. So from that sense, it's not as contaminated as some people may think. And we have put in about 30,000 experts for decontamination and have already allocated $3 billion for 2011, $6 billion for decontamination, and in 4 years we'll be spending about $15 billion. What we have learned from this, about five, I'd say, P's, importance of prediction, P for prediction, important, and also P for preparation, P for prompt response, P for public understanding, and P for post-mortem review. It's all related. Prediction, it can be 100%. So we'll do that, but we have to be prepared for everything, in a sense. Things that occur in 1,000 years can occur as well. Public understanding is very important, so we have to be very transparent, and it's our duty to share our lessons with other countries. Prompt response, and we are now having a post-mortem review in Diet, and private and government, and try to come up with lessons that we could share with others. Now, as for our energy, we were depending so much on nuclear, about 30%, and our plan was to get it to over 50% in 20 years. Now we will review this summer, but most likely we will decrease our dependency on nuclear. And we'll have to have a breakthrough in new clean energy. We are depending now on much more on thermal energy than nuclear now. But we can't go on like that, so we have to have some new energy, new storage like a new battery and smart grid as well. Now, lastly, there are many challenges, but I think I can say that we are optimistic. Three reasons. We are known to be comeback kid. 150 years ago, Japan was closed society for more than 200 years. That time, we were told to open up the country, but in about 30 years, we were prepared to become a modern society very quickly. 6 years ago, we were devastated by World War II. But less than 20 years, we came back and held whole Olympic Games and came back to, again, a industrial society. 30 years ago, we had oil shocks. Some people feared that it's the end of Japanese economic growth, but Japanese economy, industry was able to take it as a challenge, as an opportunity, and make a very energy-efficient cost. We hope that we can turn around the table again. Second reason is Japanese are now united for restoring. Very frankly, we're not known as country. The people were most with many volunteers, philanthropy. But this time, young people went out and really helped, and it is continuing. This is a very encouraging sign that I've never seen, and beyond a lot of people's expectation. Thirdly, we're not alone. We've been helped by 150 countries around the world, but most especially by you, the American people. Today, President and Vice President and other secretaries have issued a statement saying that they have really helped us and they will continue to support us. Yes, you have sent 240 ships and 240 airplanes to 20 ships and 24,000 people. That has really made the change. And you have really people, companies, churches, all have really tried to help us. That was so important for us. I remember all the incidents I have participated. No, excuse me. We are trying to start some new initiative, American-led Tomodachi Initiative, Japanese-led Kizuna Project, many projects, and I have been in the area last week. I met governors, mayors. Is there any message to Japanese people, American people, American friends? They said, please convey our thanks to American friends. Also, please say that we are recovering, but it'll take time. So, please, during that time, try to stand with us, by us, stand aside us. And that means that please do visit us. Please come to us. Please trade with us, and please invest in us. We have a special district, and we have special legislature to invite in foreign companies, investment, tax exemption, subsidies. Please use them, and I would like, again, to express how grateful we are, and I will convey this message of plea to be continue to stand with us. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Fujisaki. It's now my great privilege to invite General Mark Berlakis to make a few remarks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bush. Ambassador Fujisaki, Mr. Talbot, Mr. Bush, and Mr. Napper, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's a great honor for me to be here this afternoon on this day of commemoration in this forum to speak about the events of a year ago. I am mindful for the fact that the situation in Japan continues to be a national effort to first remember the thousands who were lost in this great disaster that befell our friend and great ally a year ago, and to understand the significant work yet to come as the government of Japan and the people of Japan work together to rebuild. I am humbled by the memory of those days, the great loss, and the ensuing efforts that went on in that nation to respond to the effects of the earthquake and the resultant tsunami. On that day, the 11th of March, I was in Tokyo to attend a reception at the U.S. Embassy. My previous personal experience with earthquakes was very minor, having not lived on the West Coast in the United States. But as I sat in the hotel and as it shook for what seemed to be an eternity, I came to understand that what I was experiencing was something truly significant. When the building finally stopped moving, my first thought was to give a silent thanks to the Japanese architects and builders who put that hotel together. because they had both, we had all, been through a great test. Soon after, the enormity of those events became quite apparent as the media started to report the results not just of the earthquake, but of the tsunami, which we now know has been one of the strongest in recorded history. And the tsunami that sprang up created the unfolding disaster in eastern Honshu. Right after that, I was contacted by my commanding general to go and report to General Burt Field, the commander of the U.S. forces in Japan. And my job was to do whatever I could to assist him. He gathered the forces that were available to him in Okinawa and in mainland Japan to come to the assistance of our Japanese allies, which had requested a U.S. military response. I also had learned that the president had made this a national priority. And the Marines, sailors, soldiers, and airmen of the United States military in Japan moved quickly to come to an ally. In those first days, probably the most important thing in disaster relief is to tie in with those that you will support. And in foreign disaster relief for us, one is the U.S. ambassador, whose mission it is to render assistance to the host nation. My responsibility was to go to Sendai and create a close working cooperation with Lieutenant General Kimizuka of the Japanese Ground Self-Defense Forces, who had been made the Joint Task Force Commander, Tohoku, for the response in Honshu. It is important because no action by the United States forces that occurred in Japan was done without the coordination with the Japanese commander and his staff and with his permission, which is an important point I think we all need to understand. Everything that we had done and everything that we did do was in cooperation and with the approval of the Japanese military and their government. That tight understanding and coordination enabled us to work cooperatively and quickly to come to the response of the people that were most need and of the greatest need. And I think overall, when we look back upon the operation and how it unfolded, we can commend ourselves for the effort, the energy, and the devotion that both nations put into this effort. Quickly deploying forces, helicopters, aircraft, ships, we started to position those forces that were necessary to come to the quickest, to provide the quickest response we could, to move people, to move supplies, and to create a hub-and-spoke system that enabled us to bring supplies to an airfield or to a landing zone, to then quickly turn them over to the Japanese self-defense forces, who then in turn distributed those down into the villages and the towns most affected by this disaster. We did that by deploying headquarters forward, by establishing airheads, and working closely with our Japanese self-defense counterparts, all of which was continuously coordinated through the self-defense forces, the U.S. forces, Japan, and also with the interagency of the United States that was working feverishly to support the Japanese government. Our operations unfolded quickly and soon ran apace of the unfolding disaster at Fukushima. We had to deal with the events that were occurring there and also to work hard to make sure that they did not interfere with our mission, which was to provide disaster relief to the people in the affected area. Our focus was to complement a very robust Japanese self-defense effort that was ongoing. Over 100,000 Japanese self-defense airmen, sailors, and soldiers were involved nonstop for an extended period of time in terrible conditions, in bad weather, with a mission that I would not wish on anybody, which was to come to the aid of their own population that had been ravaged by this disaster. The Fukushima power plant and the resultant release of radioactivity made our effort more challenging. But again, in cooperation with the Japanese self-defense forces and the government, we were able to continue nonstop the relief operations that it was our mission to accomplish. It was a great privilege to work with the Japanese self-defense forces. They are a professional, well-equipped, and well-trained force. Their level of commitment to the Japanese people was incredible. I will not deny that we had some bumps along the way. We had to get used to how each other operates. We, of course, had a significant language challenge. But the effort that came together, the Japanese Self-Defense Forces and the United States military, I think produced a great result, or as good a result as we could have hoped for the Japanese people in northeastern Honshu. General Kimizuka did an admirable job as the first operational joint task force commander in the history of the Japanese Self-Defense Forces. It was a huge task. It was complicated by the fact that the disaster was right there. There was no opportunity to prepare. There was no opportunity to identify the forces. It was come as you are. And he did a tremendous job. And I think it's manifest in the accomplishments that we managed to together. The opening of the Sendai Airport, the preparation and cleanup of the schools just prior to the beginning of the school session, and then some of the work we did up and down the coast in support of the self-defense forces. For me to be here tonight or today to represent the United States military in total is a great honor. They all did a tremendous job in supporting Japan. Most of them lived in Japan. Japan was our home. I had been living in Japan for about 20 months at that time. I have a great affinity for the Japanese people. I have great friends in Okinawa. And if you have an opportunity, just as any one of you, tonight, if you wake up and your neighbor's house is on fire, your first response, your only response, will go to the aid of your neighbor. We were given a unique opportunity to do that. And for all of us, it will be a memory that we will keep for the rest of our lives. I'd like to once again thank Mr. Talbert for hosting this event and for the ambassador for his presence as well. Sir, you do us all a great honor.
Thank you very much.
And I look forward to the remainder of the program. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, General. I would now like to invite Mark Knapper, who's the Director of Japan Affairs at the Department of State, to say a few words.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Bush, Mr. Talbot, General Berlakis, Ambassador Fujisaki. Thank you very much for this opportunity to join you today, ladies and gentlemen. I wanted to spend just a few minutes picking up one of the threads that Ambassador Fujisaki laid out for us, which is that, you know, Japan is on the road to recovery. And I'd like to use my time to hopefully counter this common perception that post-March 11th, because Japan was so focused on necessary recovery efforts in Tohoku, that it had somehow ceded its international responsibility or somehow would pay less attention to its important role on the international stage. And I think certainly no one would begrudge Japan for putting that kind of focus on its efforts domestically. But I believe that the facts, in fact, don't bear that perception out. I think that if one looks at the quality of Japan's participation internationally, the quality of our bilateral relationship, I think it's clear that Japan is still playing a vital and critically important role on the world stage and with us in the United States. I would say really in three areas. I'm sure there's many more, but I'll just focus on three. One is our global partnership. The second is our security alliance. And the third is our trade and investment and sort of scientific technology cooperative relationship. In terms of our global partnership, really, if you look at sort of every corner of the world in which the United States has major stakes, Japan is right there with us. In Afghanistan, for example, Japan, with its five-year, $5 billion commitment, Japan is second only to the United States in its desire to bring peace and reconstruction to that country. Same with Iraq. Japan is second in terms of assistance. Pakistan, just second also. Aid to the Palestinian Authority, Japan is second right behind us. So really, if you look at all the major sort of foreign policy initiatives that we place so much emphasis on, Japan is a true and great partner. Iran, of course, is another major issue, and the United States and Japan share the very important goal of getting Iran to abandon its nuclear ambitions. And to date, Japan has been a full participant in the UN sanctions regime against Iran. And in fact, along with the United States and others, say in the EU, has implemented unilateral sanctions of its own directed to get Iran back to the negotiating table to abandon its nuclear program. In terms of something like anti-piracy, it's not well known, but Japan has what's called a hub in Djibouti, from which a couple of, I think, Aegis cruisers and P-3 aircraft operate to participate in the international community's efforts to wipe out the scourge of piracy off the Horn of Africa. In terms of addressing North Korea nuclear issue, we are in virtually daily contact with our friends in Japan on this matter. In fact, just in January, we had a very high-level trilateral meeting among the U.S., Japan, and Korea to figure out steps going forward. And on sort of the issues of vital concern related to North Korea, whether it's the nuclear program, the missile program, or the abductees issue, the United States and Japan are in very close contact, particularly in the abductions issue. This is something that we take very seriously. It's an important human rights issue for us as well. And every time we see the North Koreans, we make a point of raising this issue and making the point that, you know, North Korea has to resolve to the government of Japan's satisfaction the issue of the abductees. I would say on Burma as well, this is another big issue for us. We're in close coordination with the Japanese on things like forgiving Burma's arrears and taking steps to encourage democratization and economic liberalization in that country. In fact, in April, Japan will host a summit of lower Mekong countries. Of course, Burma is one of them. And we'll have a summit meeting, I believe, between the prime minister of both countries to address important issues of democratization and otherwise. So really, in terms of just our being the U.S. sort of broad foreign policy interests, we couldn't have a better partner than Japan. In terms of the security alliance, General Braccus described very eloquently the close cooperation we had in Operation Tomodachi. And I think really that cooperative effort made an already tight alliance even tighter. I think there's something to be said. It's a very intangible thing, but something about two forces going shoulder to shoulder into harm's way that can't be duplicated in a training exercise or can't be repeated in a war game in a conference room somewhere. I mean, our two forces perform brilliantly together, and I think really, if you look now at our alliance, it's stronger than it's ever been, and this is, you know, reflecting itself in how we, during this very important time in our foreign policy, as we make this strategic pivot, as Secretary Clinton described, to the Asian region, really Japan remains our absolutely most critical ally in the Asia Pacific. We could not engage in the strategic pivot without our close friend and ally, and Japan is part of this major rethinking of our strategic posture in the region. Many are aware that we are undergoing serious discussions now on our 2006 roadmap. Talks continue, but we're very hopeful that we'll continue to work forward and push forward on this. But because of very often, I mean, the Fatemba and Okinawa issues are in the news, and that tends to cast a shadow over a lot of the other good things we have going on in our defense relationship. Many people aren't aware that for something like ballistic missile defense, Japan is our closest partner, and really we couldn't make the kind of advances we have to date without the cooperation and assistance of the Japanese government. In terms of peacekeeping operations, Japan made the bold decision to send self-defense forces to South Sudan to participate in PKO operations there. And really, in addition to operations already going on in East Timor, previous ones in Haiti after the earthquake, in Pakistan after the flooding, and these are all ways in which our two forces have engaged together to create a stronger alliance for the benefit of peace and stability in the region. Third, just in terms of the economic and trade relationship between our two countries, of course, many of you know Japan is our fourth largest trading partner. It's the second largest investor in the United States. We're the first largest investor, I guess you say the largest investor in Japan. And really, this kind of close trade and investment relationship has continued unabated since 3/11, and would expect it to continue to deepen. Of course, there's been a lot of interest recently in the discussions surrounding the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We welcome Japan's interest in joining this, and we'll continue to have very good and close discussions as we proceed forward with those. One sort of unsung aspect of our bilateral relationship is the science and technology cooperation our two countries enjoy, that our scientists and researchers have you know, very often, I mean, they get along just fine without anybody from the State Department looking over their shoulder. But from NASA to the National Institutes of Health to our national labs and Japanese national labs, on a day-to-day basis, our experts are collaborating and working very closely together and helping to further undergird our very strong relationship. And this, too, has continued unabated since March 11th. In fact, I think it was our scientists and researchers who went over post 3/11 to help their counterparts in Japan address some of the issues related to the nuclear problem. Really, they were able just to pick up and begin work right away because they had been working with their counterparts for years, decades in some cases, and they were able to call their friends and say, okay, what can we do to help? But I'd be remiss if I left you thinking that everything was sanguine in the relationship. There's one area that, as a former student in Japan, I feel strongly about, and that's exchange programs between our two countries. I think we can do better. Both of our countries can do better. Right now, there's about 6,600 young Americans studying in Japan. I think it could be twice that number. It should be twice that number, if not more. Currently, there's about 25,000 Japanese young people studying in the U.S. Japan used to be the largest sending country of young people. Now it's fourth behind China, India, and South Korea. And I think you know, we ought to do something about this, and we are. Here in the U.S., we have something called the Tomodachi Initiative, or Tomodachi for short, in which, with primarily a focus on the Tohoku area, but really trying to inspire young people to get closer to their American counterparts through educational, cultural, arts, sports exchanges, entrepreneurship training, that sort of thing. And that's now underway and is going great. The ambassador mentioned Kizuna, which is a Japanese foreign ministry program to send Japanese high schoolers here during the summer. And so we're really hopeful that between these two programs, we can help stem the sort of the backwards tide of young people going to each other's countries. So I think with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. We now have a few minutes before our very busy speakers have to get back to their day jobs. Yes?
Usually I should not correct Director Japan Desk in front of people, but can I just make one correction?
By all means.
Kizuna Project, it's to send 1,000 students and invite 1,000 high school students.
Even better.
It's both ways. Thank you very much.
Okay. With that correction, we now open the floor. Once I call on you, please wait for the mic. Please identify yourself. Please indicate to whom your question is addressed, and please keep your question short. Who would like to ask the first question? Volunteers? Yes. Wait for the mic, please.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Llewellyn Dwyer. I'm from National Defense University. And the question I had was the issue of public trust after the disaster and how the young people especially are reacting and using technology to help themselves.
Who'd like to?
Well, certainly not in my lane.
Mr. Bassett.
I'm sorry, I didn't get it. Could you please?
Oh, sure. One of the examples I heard from a State Department colleague was after the tsunami, Ambassador Roos, who was a big tweeter after the disaster, had said information that I guess conflicted with what the Japanese government was saying about radiation and nuclear. So kind of if you can explain a little bit how the Japanese people felt about the response.
I see. I don't know about this Twitter of Ambassador Roos and the discrepancy between Japanese government, but as for evacuation area, there was a difference because U.S. Set a 50-mile zone and Japan set about 80-mile zone. There was a clear difference in the area because, people were, the Japanese cabinet ministers were asked, why is it so different? And the Japanese minister explained that if you are It's very natural that if you're in your country or if it's in a foreign country, you would rather take a conservative view. For example, if there's something occurring in foreign country, you would advise not to travel, anything like that. So as for evacuation field, you would take it more conservatively or widely the areas. And maybe there could be those. But as for that, now it's the same region, about 12 miles zone between, and the U.S. has come down to the same level. But as for this Twitter, I'm sorry, I do not know.
Mark? If I can just elaborate a little bit on the ambassador's point regarding the evacuation zones. Really, the primary responsibility of any U.S. embassy in any country is to the safety and the welfare of American citizens residing there. And when we were making a decision about how far to extend the evacuation zone, we applied the same standards that we would have used in the event of a similar accident in our own country. So really, it wasn't a question of who had what information at what time and basing it on different facts and sort of that sort of thing. It was really just we had the same information. We just had a different set of standards that we applied. And as the ambassador said, we moved and now we're in exact concert with the Japanese recommendation.
Another question? My colleague, Jonathan Pollock.
Yes, Jonathan Pollock from Brookings. Ambassador Fujisaki, I'm wondering whether you could offer some observations about the debate in Japan about nuclear power in the aftermath of the disaster. Prime Minister Noda has certainly made some strong statements about Japan, the future of the industry. Do you see nuclear power still being a core part of Japan's future energy identity and structure? Japan, of course, being one of the countries that has depended so much on nuclear power for its energy needs.
Yes. As for nuclear power generation reactor, U.S. is 104, world's number one. Japan, France is 57 with number two, and Japan is 54 with number three. So, and as you know, our dependency was between 25 to 30%, and our plan was to increase it in 20 years to 50%. Now, for example, after 3 miles, for 30 years, U.S. made no nuclear reactor on the United States, and Japan was making 29 in the world number one. Now, you look at the polls in Japan, and people are becoming a little cautious. This is after there was no death toll, immediate death toll from reactor, but people are becoming cautious. So in the energy mix that we will be reviewing, we'll be making this summer, I think that plan to double will be changed, and we will look at some new plan. And as Prime Minister, as you have said, is indicating that we will continue, but we will decrease the dependency. And but for that, of course, we have to have an energy which is would make Japanese economy competitive as well. And we cannot jump to some new energy which is not efficient from economic point of view. So we have to find the right mix, but this is something we will be doing in the course of this year. But we'll have to find the right energy mix from the point of energy efficiency, safety, the people's consciousness as well.
Okay. Gentleman over here, and then I'll go to the back.
Thank you very much. My name is Brian Martin. I worked for Congressman Gene Taylor from Mississippi Gulf Coast on Hurricane Katrina recovery for 5 years. And one of the things that I worked on was disaster insurance. And so I'm curious how the Japanese earthquake insurance program, how well it functioned. Is when you have these mega catastrophes, it's sort of beyond the capacity of the capital reserves of private insurance. And so in case of Katrina and in case of Northridge earthquake and other big disasters in the United States, the government's had to come in and do a lot of assistance housing programs and grants and other assistance because they're uncovered losses. We looked at reform and saw the Japanese earthquake insurance as a real model of a public-private partnership, whereas I understand it, private insurance covers up to a point, and then if it's a really major disaster, the government is the reinsurer. And so I'm curious how well that functioned to cover the property losses.
I'm sorry, I am not in a position right now to give you a very clear country answer, but that is things that we have to sort out. But now private, for example, for nuclear disaster, electric companies are trying to find the right compensation. The government is extending the condolence and local communities as well, and we, as I said, we have received so much from international communities, so we are passing this out. But as for the insurance itself, I'm sorry, I cannot give you the very clear answer on that. Thank you.
Mark, do you have anything?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yuki Tatsumi?
Hi, Yuki Tatsumi from Simpson Center. I have
I
a
hope
question.
She will not ask question to me.
I will not, actually.
She has free
I actually do have a question to General Berlakis. One of the issues the self-defense forces will tackle as they move forward, gathering their lessons learned, is how to care for the perhaps mental health of the sailor, airman, soldier who were engaged in the disaster relief. And if you were in 3MAF or U.S. Forces Japan, and asked for advice by your counterpart in Japan in terms of how to approach that, what kind of advice would you give them?
Thanks, Yuki. Good to see you.
It's
a great question, and it is one of those things that the self-defense forces will have to deal with. Like I said, it was a very emotional event. You can't be a citizen of a country that goes through a great disaster, be a military professional who goes in to do that and not be affected either by the sights, the smells, the combination of all those things that were there. And it was very difficult. I saw truly admirable efforts by the Japanese self-defense forces, the soldiers who would go into the affected areas initially to try and find the survivors and then again to go back and find the remains. Again and again, very, very difficult, very emotional work. Some soldiers who were doing it in one area when they knew very well that their own family had been in the middle of the tsunami in a different area. And like I said, General Kimizuka spent a great amount of time working on the morale of his people. During our relief operations, there was, in fact, a consideration for that. And a number of military professionals from the United States gathered and they had a seminar with Japanese self-defense force doctors, chaplains, religious professionals, et cetera, to go through what we have been experiencing over 10 years of combat operations with post-traumatic stress and other conditions that arise from those kind of highly emotional and highly charged activities. It was very well received, a lot of great questions, and I'm sure, I can't say affirmatively, but I'm sure that that kind of dialogue has continued through U.S. Forces Japan and the military, not just in Japan itself, but bringing experts forward from the United States back to Japan.
Thank you. The woman in the back for the last question.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Sadako Shimori from TV Asahi. Since Japan-U.S. alliance is so tightened, as you mentioned right now, so we can expect Prime Minister's visit in spring, I think. We know it is mainly the problem of the Japanese domestic issues, domestic political issues, but could you just tell us the timeline and your level of the preparation for the Prime Minister Noda's visit this spring, Mr. Napper and Ambassador Fujisaki? Thank you.
Mark, you're the host.
Well, I'm suffice to say nothing's been decided yet, but we're still in very close consultations with Ambassador Fujisaki and his staff and, of course, our embassy in Tokyo and their counterparts in the government to try and work out. We, of course, would love to have the Prime Minister visit.
Ambassador?
I think this Prime Minister's visit is very important. We would like to make it not only problem-solving, but very forward-looking one, future-oriented one as well. And we will have to nail down the timing. We have not done yet, but we will work on with the Mr. Napier and State Department to have a substantial visit as possible. Thank you very much for the question, Ms. Shimbori.
Thank you all. I'd like to acknowledge my colleague, Peter Singer, who's the director of our 21st Century Defense Initiative, with whom we have co-sponsored this program, and Peter and his staff have been very helpful. Thanks to each of the three gentlemen here who made presentations. Thank you all for coming. Please take a moment this weekend to remember the events of last year. Otherwise, have a great weekend. Thank you.